Live from America's finest city, this is Real Talk San Diego on ESPN 1700. And now, your hosts, Ryan White and David McKelvin.
Welcome, welcome, welcome. Happy 3rd of July to everybody out there. Tomorrow's a pretty big day. It's the Real Estate Radio Hour, 1700 AM, with your host, Ryan White. Today, we have with us Cinda Jones. She is a CFP, a CDFA. We're going to have her explain what that is. But ultimately, she is with Divorce Financial Solutions. Their website, divorcefinancialsolutions.com. That's the website, divorcefinancialsolutions.com. So, Cinda, what does a CFP and a CDFA mean?
A CFP is a certified financial planner, and a CDFA is a certified divorce financial analyst.
Wow. So, obviously, you're in the money world.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Yes. Okay. And your website being divorcefinancialsolutions.com, I'm guessing that what you do mostly is finances surrounding divorce, right?
Yes. I work exclusively with people who are going through divorce, either individuals or couples.
Got it. And divorce, obviously, there's a massive upheaval in the person's day-to-day life. 50% of marriages or thereabouts are ending in divorce, right? That's a huge number.
The longer people are married, the less likely they are to divorce. But then the longer they're married, the more the financial complexities come into the picture.
The more they need somebody like you.
Yes.
So we're really talking about the unmarriage of people, the unwinding of essentially a business. I mean, to some degree, when you get married, you're creating a business together. And in the end, if that business is to dissolve, there's a variety of ways one goes through the dissolution process of a business, and similar for a marriage. Now, you had kind of mentioned before the show that there were a variety of different types of ways to get divorced, which is not something I would have normally considered. You kind of suggested that most people hire an attorney, go for the cheapest one, they do whatever that attorney says that they should do. But sounds like that's not the right way to go about it.
No, I think that's a critical issue that is seldom addressed, and that is to concentrate at the beginning. It's difficult because there's a lot of emotion going on, but to, if a couple can or an individual can, think about what kind of a process they want to have. How do they want to feel at the end of it? Do they feel they've been fully informed, that they have negotiated with all the facts? You can get that in a litigated case. You can get the negotiations and you can get the facts, but how a person feels about it, and to minimize regret, it's a good idea to look at other divorce alternatives other than litigation, strictly speaking, to pick an attorney that will fit the process that the individual has in mind. So mediation might work better, collaborative might work better. It could be a cooperative divorce. People can do their own divorces. I don't encourage people to do that, particularly if they have children and assets, because it is a legal matter that does need to be sorted out in the legal context.
We're talking with Cinda Jones, her website, divorcefinancialsolutions.com, divorcefinancialsolutions.com, about different ways that people can get divorced. And we've written down five of them here, and you just mentioned them, but I'm going to go over them again. Collaborative, mediation, litigation, cooperative, and self. I think we get the idea of what self is. Unfortunately, we probably all get the idea of what litigation is, too. Explain briefly collaborative, mediation, and cooperative, and how they're different.
Okay. Mediation is where there's one mediator, one person, and that person is a neutral. They don't represent either person. So generally speaking, people who are involved in a mediation process using a mediator will have consulting attorneys outside of that process, where they take different alternatives to the attorneys and discuss it. But the mediator will facilitate the negotiations, help them, and in fact do the marital settlement agreement. And so mediation mediation is usually a three-person meeting with the mediator and the two parties who are getting divorced.
So the attorneys don't enter the room?
They, generally speaking, do not. They can. Sometimes that's what's necessary, is for the individuals and the attorneys to come to the mediator's office and negotiate there with their clients.
It seems to me that the mediation approach would work best for people that have less disdain for each other.
There needs to be, for it to work.
Of course, for it to work.
For it to work, there needs to be parity. If there's a huge disparity of knowledge or understanding, a disparity of control, then mediation, I would think, not be the best alternative.
Okay. What about collaborative?
Collaborative is a process where the attorneys and the clients enter into a non-litigation mode, where all the facts are discovered, understood, discussed, and it is a supportive process of the family and the individuals, and it has the same consequences, or can have the same consequences, as a litigated divorce, but it is in the terms of sharing and understanding and keeping the family in a more cooperative mode.
I had one attorney explain to me at one point in time, and he asked the couple, did the dad want to be able to dance with the daughter at her daughter's wedding?
And we sometimes use that approach in collaborative, and sometimes we take the pictures of the children and put them on the table, because it's easy to get upset and there is a lot at stake. But the goal is that the children would be central. And even if there are not children, people can walk away from a collaborative process with a better feeling about themselves and maybe the other person, and then their future relationships might be better. If you leave the divorce really angry, you're probably going to stay really angry for a while. And ideally, people will resolve their issues in a full context, and that can happen in collaborative.
Okay, the last one, cooperative.
Right. Cooperative is an open process where there's information shared, where there's two attorneys. But the difference between collaborative and cooperative is that in the collaborative process, a stipulation is signed that there won't be litigation. And if one side wants to drop out from the litigation, then they lose their attorney, and the process ends. In a cooperative case, the attorneys can go forward with the individuals into litigation. It's generally not the intent at the beginning, but that door is open to them.
Got it. So as in the collaborative scenario, the attorneys pre-agree not to be the attorney that goes to trial, where in cooperative, that could be the case.
Yes, that's exactly
right.
Wow,
some very distinct differences here. Don't bother trying to memorize them. Go to her website, seek her out, Cinda Jones, divorcefinancialsolutions.com. That's the website, divorcefinancialsolutions.com. I certainly hope you don't find yourself in this scenario, but she's very quick to point out she is not an attorney, right?
Not an attorney at all.
You're essentially a financial advocate, and really unpeeling the layers, so to speak, as far as, you know, who makes what and giving people an understanding of where the money comes from, and, well, kind of letting them decide where it goes, but at least where it comes from and how much it is.
Yes, and making sure that both parties understand, or even if I'm working with one person, that they understand that they have choices and there's consequences that can be different from one settlement and alternative compared to another. And that isn't always clear in the chaos or the fog of divorce, is what is this going to look like at the end?
Yeah, it really seems that although people are hiring you for your numerical analysis, your Excel spreadsheet, if you will, seems like there's a lot of therapy that goes along with it.
There's some therapy that goes along with it, because people are upset.
Oh, yeah. It makes a lot of sense. So, again, if you find yourself in this situation, just getting the process started, seek her out. She can point you in the right direction, because some attorneys specialize in one method or the other, or perhaps don't believe in a certain method. And you want to make sure you choose an attorney that has, well, I guess, the same ideals with respect to resolution process as you do, right?
I think that's an excellent point. And if there's one thing I'd like to leave today with is that people would know that they do have choices, and picking the attorney that matches the choice they'd like to make is very important.
Yeah, I would imagine the choice they'd like to make has a lot to do with the outcome they'd like. And, you know, perhaps backing that through to determine a process and then an attorney, as opposed to the guy who's just the least expensive.
Right. That wouldn't be the measure that a person should use when there's a lot at stake. And there's so much that people don't have a way of knowing. They can't know the questions to ask and what their choices are.
Got it. Yeah, I mean, the outcome of this unmarriage, this separation of a business, will have ripple effects throughout the rest of their lives.
It will have a ripple effect on their children, and it will have a definite consequences to their future financially.
Absolutely. Yes. Again, we're talking with Cinda Jones. Divorce Financial Solutions is her business. So you've got on here most important points about negotiations, avoiding financial mistakes, key issues, and businesses in San Diego are small businesses. And that's one of the things you bring to the table here is the ability to evaluate this small business to determine, you know, if someone is fighting, one of the divorcing parties are fighting for business or a pension or something like that. Really what you're able to do is determine the value of something that's not necessarily quantifiable, right?
Well, I don't do business valuations. We do get those from other people, but I can quantify with the business valuator, or by reviewing the investments and by looking at the retirement plans, we can put a dollar value on it, and then people can talk about the dollar value as well as the consequence to the different alternatives.
Right. So when people understand they're fighting about a certain thing. I mean, if it's a bank account with money and a CD, pretty cut and dry. But many of the assets out there are not so easy to evaluate. And one of the things you do is you simplify that so that, real frankly, they understand what they're arguing about.
Yes, and particularly with retirement plans, they're more complicated than most people believe or that they understand. There's so many choices with that have long-term consequences, and unless those different alternatives are evaluated so that there isn't a surprise later on, people can have significant regrets about how they handled pension plans or some other asset.
That makes a lot of sense. Again, we're talking with Cinda Jones, her website, divorcefinancialsolutions.com. That's her website, divorcefinancialsolutions.com. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about avoiding financial mistakes and some key issues associated with that ahead of us when we come back. Welcome back. We've been talking with Cinda Jones with Divorce Financial Solutions, her website, divorcefinancialsolutions.com. One time, divorcefinancialsolutions.com. We highlighted the five most prominent ways that one can get unmarried and the idea of selecting an attorney that best meets the needs of, well, the end result you're hoping and how you want that process to look. And Cinda is a great resource to point you in the right direction. One more time, find our website, divorcefinancialsolutions.com. We talked a little bit about business evaluations, but we're going to skip around a little bit and talk about avoiding financial mistakes, because I really think that is the crux of what you bring to the table, is to make sure that people don't do that. I would imagine there's a lot of emotion running around when you're going through this process, and it's easy to make a mistake, or perhaps what doesn't even seem like a mistake now, but at some point in the future pops up as a mistake. You've got on your list here, making quick decisions usually causes problems later. That makes a lot of sense. Can you give me some examples of how that plays out?
Sometimes at the beginning, because people are uncomfortable and unhappy, they want to get out of that place, so they make promises to each other, or they'll make their deals, or they'll sit down and say, well, I'll do this and you do that, you'll get the house, I'll keep my pension. Then that's a very common example. And then as the process unfolds and they have more information, then one of them could very easily say, oh, I can't do that. You know, I can't keep the house, or I'm not going to give you my pension in lieu of the house. And so those are the early decisions that people make, that as they get more information, they're sorry. Then when they take their promise back, that can just aggravate the circumstances.
We've experienced that where a couple was separating, and just like you're describing, one got the pension, one got the house, and it was brought to us to determine, well, you know, the value of the house. And so it was actually the wife who got the house, and, you know, she was very happy, and she thought the home was worth $800,000, and actually she was dead on. The home was worth $800,000. But what she didn't take into account, and it was too late for us to get involved, that they owed $725,000 on it. So in terms of actual value, it was only like 10% of equity in the home, where the pension was, you know, several hundred thousand dollars. And I don't exactly know why she didn't know, you know, what was owed on the home. She must have gotten involved in the mortgage payment. I don't exactly know how that process played out. But it certainly seemed like, you know, a great example of what you're describing there, where she made this decision without all the information. I would imagine a person like you would have obviously advised her that that's not an equitable trade with respect to that.
Right. I can imagine how she feels, but I can't imagine how something like that would happen. But things do. And people sometimes just don't know, and they simply don't understand. And then later on, they have such huge regret, and they can be very angry with themselves, not to mention angry with the other person. So, another thing in connection with the house is someone might want to keep it, then they can't afford it. And what do you do with a mortgage if both names are on it, or can it be refinanced or can it not? And what are the tax consequences?
Yeah, that's a very common problem, in that most of the time, both people are on title and both people are on the mortgage. And changing who's on title is relatively simple. $20, you sign a piece of paper, and you can change someone for being on title. But who's financially responsible for the mortgage? That's a whole different story. And if you're to, let's say, give the wife the home, the husband is going to be financially tied to that mortgage until they refinance the property and put it in the wife's name completely, which would allow the husband to free up that debt on paper and, you know, move on with his life, so to speak, in this example. And commonly, that's a problem. I mean, I run across that a lot. I would imagine you see it too.
I do. And it's unfortunate, because sometimes when people do divorces themselves, they think all they need to do is change title. And you and I know that that doesn't have any effect or isn't binding on the lender. They can even say in their agreement the other person is entirely responsible, but the lender can take an entirely different view on that.
It's always been my experience that they do. Now, the couple could be okay with the fact that, in this case, the husband is still a signer on the loan, and, you know, he's of the opinion that it's okay. He's happy being half financially responsible for the property, even though she gets all the ownership. But more often than not, he wants complete separation so that the other party can move on with their life. We talked with Bruce McPherson here a little bit, and he's kind of got that reverse mortgage situation, which might be a solution to keep someone in the home as opposed to during the refinance process. He talked about it great length in the previous segment there. Okay, so making quick decisions usually causes problems later. I think that's, frankly, a life lesson.
Yes.
It's not just divorce, right?
Right, exactly.
Choose any scenario, a quick decision commonly is a problem. So someone like yourself is there to hold their hand, so to speak, and make sure they're going down the right path?
Well, to point out, here's some consequences, or here's some things to think about. And, you know, again, in the house, being able to afford it, but then not being able to afford it later, and then selling it, and then bearing the capital gains consequences as a single person rather than as a couple, because the tax exemption is different.
Right. And what's the difference amount? It's substantial.
Right.
So for a single person, a capital gains exemption for a primary residence is $250,000 now. And for a married couple, it's $500,000. So a $250,000 difference, which, let's say, a third of that could be a difference of about $80,000 in taxes needing to be paid by changing who lives in the home and changing who's on title. Substantial difference.
Yes.
Yeah. I bet a lot of people don't necessarily see that coming up. In the scenario I described, where they owed $725,000 and it was worth $800,000, well, that wasn't a problem.
Right.
Fortunately or unfortunately, however you want to look at that. But Okay, second point here, attempting to speed up the process ahead of understanding information and choices that cause problems. That's probably not that different than making decisions quickly.
No. Well, it is it is a little different in that people will think, well, we'll be done with this in 6 months. And sometimes people can, but that means the financial matters are straightforward. They can come to an agreement. It's common for a divorce to take a year, or it might even take longer than that. So people get impatient. It's understandable that they do, but if it isn't done right, then there's worse consequences later.
So a divorce can take 6 months to a year, huh?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yes. Okay. Now, there's some stipulation between when you file and separate, and there's a certain time frame you have to wait, kind of like buying a gun, right? You got to wait 2 weeks from when you buy it to actually receive it. What's the waiting period for a divorce nowadays?
It's 6 months after you file.
So you file, and 6 months later, it can be finalized.
Right.
No sooner than that.
No sooner than that. That's what the attorneys tell me. That's a legal question.
Got it. Okay. Well, good disclaimer. So that's our cooling off period, right? Yeah. That's the idea. So for the most part, it's not going to be sooner than 6 months, but a year is not uncommon in terms of duration.
No, and people will start their negotiations and they'll engage in the process, and then maybe they'll file later. It depends on what process choice they use, but they will, in their mind, it's been going on for a long time, but they didn't file. I've worked with people that have been separated for many years sometimes and haven't filed.
Mm, got it. Well, you know, with the understanding, which I was unaware of, that a divorce can easily take a year, it certainly makes more sense that people would make mistakes to attempt to speed the process up with, like I said, it taking at least easily a year. Makes a whole lot more sense that that would happen. Not knowing the questions to ask or where to get the information. I mean, I think all of what we're talking about is informationally based, right? That's the whole idea. And that's really your job, right?
That's my job, right. And people will search on the internet, and they can learn a lot there. They can go to classes. There are organizations in town that have classes that are really helpful. Janita Wall has second Saturday, and the Conflict Resolution Center has third Saturday, and there's other different education classes. And so it never hurts to repeat and to think about it again and loop back and learn more, because there's acronyms and terminology and concepts that aren't part of our everyday knowledge base.
So the second Saturday and third Saturday are free seminars on how people can understand how to get divorced. Is that what that is?
They're not free, but the cost is very small in comparison to the information that's gained.
But it's about how people can get divorced? Is that
Absolutely.
What it's about?
Absolutely, yep.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. So it kind of seems like you've positioned yourself in the middle of this, you know, the hub, so to speak, of the wheel, allowing you to direct people to the right resource. And it might be go to this second Saturday class. You're already there. You know, hey, we don't completely advocate doing it yourself, but if you're insisting on doing so, go take a few classes so that, you know, kind of seems like you can point people in the right direction as an advocate for the method they want to go through.
Yes, I like it when if people will or can or if they can contact me before they make process choices or maybe even attorney choices, because I hopefully could talk to them and then send them in the right direction, because there's a significant differences.
To get a hold of Cinda, her website is divorcefinancialsolutions.com. That's her website. divorcefinancialsolutions.com. If you do unfortunately find yourself in the beginning, middle, or end stages of the process there, reach out to her. She might be able to help point you in the right direction, give you some idea of where to get started. Again, hope that you don't find yourself in that situation, but should you do so, reach out to Cinda. One more time, divorcefinancialsolutions.com. That's the website, divorcefinancialsolutions.com. When we come back, we're going to talk about some key issues and some of the most important points to negotiate about when going through the process. Ahead of us when we come back. Welcome back. back. ESPN 1700 AM. It's the Real Estate Radio Hour. We've been talking with Cinda Jones, DivorceFinancialSolutions.com. That's our website, DivorceFinancialSolutions.com. During the break here, Cinda and I were talking. It really seems like retirement plan evaluation is one of the ways you're really able to add value here. And to the novice, like myself, I'm happy to say I've never been divorced. Retirement plan seems very simple. I know how much money's in there. We split it in half. Boom, we're done. But doesn't sound like that's the case.
No, not for all retirement plans. It isn't. There's the defined contribution kind of a plan, which is an IRA or a 401k or a 403b. And those have a current value and they can be divided. Sometimes one person will take all of one and then a piece of another, so it doesn't have to be 50% of each one. But there are other kinds of pension plans called a defined benefit plan, and those are the plans that pay a monthly amount on retirement. There aren't as many of those kinds of plans around today, but they're still out there. There are pension plans that are more complicated, for instance, CalSTRS or CalPERS. Those have an element of a joined interest or separating the interest in the plans, and people always don't or sometimes don't know what that means to them in terms of a monthly benefit. How much are they going to get? How much are they going to give up? How much is that plan worth today that they might trade the assets for? So there's different kinds of pension plans, and they're not all that straightforward.
No, it definitely does not sound as straightforward as I would have assumed. And one of the goals, you go and look at what kind of pension plan they have and make advice on where the money is going to go, when you're going to have to take it, how much you're supposed to draw, things like that.
Right. It's important to know how much each person might get. We can't know for certain, but particularly if someone's a long ways away from retirement. But all of that really should be disclosed. I've seen people give up pension plans or, for instance, with CalSTRS to take the segregation method versus the time formula method. And there's differences in those plans that they need to understand before they make those decisions.
Well, what's the segregation method and what's the time formula method?
The segregation method is where the plan is divided and there's two separate accounts that are set up. With the time formula, the two individuals, in a sense, ride along in the same boat until retirement occurs. So one of the disadvantages might be is that a person who wanted to get that retirement money earlier couldn't until the employee retires. The advantage of it might be that there might be a little more money. The number of months that a person is employed during the marriage compared to the full scope of their employment, that determines the percentage under the time formula. So the percentage would stay the same, but the person might earn more money, and so they might get the same percentage but of a larger amount. So those are just some of the examples. There's no way to know with a lot of certainty about these things, but it's important that the concepts be understood.
Well, it does sound complicated, that's for sure. And don't feel like you have to go at this alone. If you do find yourself in this unfortunate situation, reach out to Cinda, DivorceFinancialSolutions.com. That's their website, DivorceFinancialSolutions.com. Okay, so let's talk about the important points to consider, to fight for, to reinforce when going through this divorce negotiations. You've got four of them here, and I would imagine there's more than four, but these are the most important, I would guess. Does that sound right?
Yes, those are the ones.
Okay, well, this seems fairly intuitive. The kids,
kids.
I mean, that makes a lot of sense. Tell me about the kids.
Well, they can get lost in the process, and sometimes their voice isn't heard because they're afraid to tell their parents maybe how they feel. They don't want to alienate either parent, and sometimes one person will think the other person is a terrible parent, but the child still needs and wants the love of that parent. So it's really important to try and keep as much chaos and anger away from them, not speak ill of the other parent. I've heard the terminology that it's an arrow that you send out through the heart of your child and ends up your thinking with the other person, but they all go through the children.
Got it. And I would imagine that's many people's number one place to get at their spouse. I mean, especially if it's a contentious marriage or divorce, I guess it is, seems like a easy outlet to get at the other one.
Well, sometimes people just, they don't realize how their anger and upset is being perceived by the child. So it's not always easy to keep their emotions down. And most of the people that I see love and care about their children would never deliberately hurt their children. There are people out there who do that, but it's just the day-to-day things. It's in turmoil for everyone, and the more people can keep it calm and cooperate, and as the years go by, it'll all work itself out as long as everybody tries to be respectful.
It's good advice. So you talk about here transition into schedules. So that would be who picks up, who drops off, where do I stay with? You know, what's a common schedule that people are able to negotiate?
Well, they vary, but there is that transition period. You know, it can be every other weekend, or it can be two or three times a week. It can be for dinner, it can be overnights or not, depending on the age of the child and what their schedule is. Some of the difficulty that I see is where there isn't enough money for both people to maintain their lifestyle as they have in the past, and so we'll just say in this case it's the mother. It could be the father. I mean, we see today a lot of women who earn as much or more and maybe even stay-at-home dads. So what happens then, sometimes the person who's been at home taking care of the children can't do that anymore just because they can't financially swing it. And so then the person who took care of the children all the time can take care of them less. There has to be childcare, and there has to be more cooperation from the person who was working all the time before. Now they need to take up more of the responsibility for shepherding the children to different events or taking care of them. So it's a tough time for families.
Yeah, I can see how that would be exceedingly trying if you have one person who's the primary caregiver and one person who's the primary wage earner, and now you're splitting that up. The primary wage earner perhaps has to be more of a caregiver. And the primary caregiver, do they now become a little bit more of a wage earner?
Yes.
That's forced to go back to work, like you're describing, in some capacity, right? And to fill that gap, so to speak.
Yes.
Yeah, I can see how that'd be, especially if you've been in the capacity of being primary caregiver for 5 to 10 years, which is a lifetime now in our industry. The ability to go out there and earn a reasonable wage, $1 per hour, has got to be substantially diminished.
That's an example of one of the circumstances that happens in divorce, where the working person who's been the primary wage earner and bringing in all the money, and they'll say, well, now this other person needs to go to work, and maybe they do, but the expectation of what they can earn is sometimes unrealistic, because when you've been out of a career, even for as short a period as 2 years, that has an impact on your earning capacity.
Oh, yeah, I would think so, yeah. Mm-hmm. 5 years, would seem like a lifetime in industry around here. Yeah, I would imagine that's a very large disparity between what the two can go out and make on an hourly basis. Okay, let's see here. Negotiate realistic and workable financial agreements during the transition pending final dissolution. Oh, that makes a lot of sense, especially if it takes a whole year to get this process over with. The person who's primary caregiver got to have some money, right?
Got to have some money. Who's going to pay the bills? And the more angry people are and the less they talk to each other, the more difficulties it creates. So if they can sit down together and say, who's going to make the mortgage payments, and come to some kind of understanding about transitioning into what's going to happen with the house? Because there aren't immediate answers. The best answers are the ones that evolve by looking at the choices about who's going to do what and what needs to be done. I like to say, well, how do we keep the wheels on the bus so that the family as a whole can continue on down the road? And it doesn't have to be forever, but when people just summarily close bank accounts and stop making payments and don't cooperate or maybe cancel the health insurance or something, those things are have dire consequences, and it's not an appropriate way to handle your divorce process.
So people just go cancel bank accounts or remove somebody from a bank account?
They do.
Wow. And same thing with health insurance.
They're not supposed to do that.
Of course.
There's legal consequences for that. Yeah, right. That's because then if the other person gets sick or get in a car accident, you've canceled their health insurance, and you could be responsible for all those medical bills. So, but that's an example of how people just react and don't think in their best mind.
Yeah, I can really see how coming up with a solution for that intermediary period while you're in the divorce, the escrow time, if you'll pardon the real estate example, the escrow time of the divorce, coming up with a financial arrangement is very touch and go through that process, especially if people are mad at each other, which I would imagine is commonly the case.
Well, I'm surprised. The number of people who, they may be angry with each other, but they can hold their emotions in a proper place and go ahead with business. So, and then there are people who just can't. But it's important to maintain the financial stability of the family and to make plans and arrangements that fit the circumstances.
Makes a lot of sense. You've got here a fourth one on your list: negotiate with realistic expectation, goals, and objectives. What should be a realistic expectation, goal, and objective?
That everything will, just about everything will change. That would be the realistic expectation.
Okay.
And to try to have some patience with oneself as well as the other person, because the best answers are the ones that are carefully thought out and examined. So hopefully people can do that.
We're talking with Cinda Jones, CFP, CDFA, DivorceFinancialSolutions.com. That's her website, DivorceFinancialSolutions.com is her website, talking about some of the most important negotiation points to make sure you consider when going through the divorce process. Feel free to reach out to her if you have questions. One more time, DivorceFinancialSolutions.com. When we come back, we're going to talk about some of the key issues involved in the process ahead of us when we come back. Back, ESPN 1700 AM. It's the Real Estate Radio Hour. We've been talking with Cinda Jones, Divorce Financial Solutions. We're going to talk about some of the key issues here and how support works and the difference between spousal support and child support. Sounds pretty important.
Yes, it is important. And I'm going to be talking about in general concepts and numbers, because they are complicated subjects and tied very much to the legal part of this. But for spousal support, alimony is the word that the IRS uses. And alimony or spousal support, California terminology, is that it's taxable. So that's another consideration. Someone will say, well, I'm getting $5,000 a month in spousal support. And they may spend $5,000 a month, and then they find out that they owe taxes on it.
So is it a write-off for the person who pays it?
It is a write-off for the person who pays it.
Got it. And taxable income for the person who receives it. Well, that seems fair.
It seems okay. Yeah.
Got it. Okay.
And so sometimes a person will say, well, I'm not going to pay or I don't want to pay that much in terms of spousal support, whoever that person who's paying
sometimes
is.
Sometimes they say that?
Yeah.
Okay. I would imagine they always say, I don't want to pay that much.
Well, there are people who don't, but but we take into consideration that it is a tax write-off. So the out-of-pocket money is less than the actual dollar amount that's sent over to the other
person.
Okay.
Okay.
Right.
Got it.
Yeah. And then child support is not taxable to the person who receives it, and it is not tax deductible by the person who pays it.
And really?
Yeah.
Huh.
So that's just money that gets traded.
So that's interesting. The IRS draws a distinction between the two. I would have not guessed that.
Yep. I don't know the origins of that, but that's how it's done.
So I'm to understand that spousal support or alimony can be used in a loan application.
Yes, right. It can. It depends on the lender. It depends on how long a person has been receiving support. You can include that as part of the criteria to the lender, or you can leave it out of the picture. So, they usually want to see 6 months of
receiving
spousal
it.
Support, a history of it, right?
Yeah, you become really reliant on the, ex-spouse writing you that check every month, right?
Yes.
And right. Although they're legally bound to do so, people still don't.
Sometimes they don't.
Yeah, and that puts the lender in a precarious position if they're not receiving that income. But it certainly appears that it would be a solution for refinancing the property, taking it out of the, whoever's leaving the home's name, and allowing alimony to go on your loan application and to allow you to refinance the home. It seems like a solution to that problem.
Right. That's helpful when people have a solid agreement and there's enough financial resources for them to be able to make the payment, to refinance it. And sometimes they'll refinance to get the other person off the loan, to divide the equity. Mm-hmm. So there's important reasons to have support all around.
Right. Maybe they do cash out. There's $300,000 in equity. They take an extra $150,000 out, give that to the spouse who's leaving, and they're left with a mortgage that's, $150,000 more, but it's a way of dividing the asset, I suppose.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And sometimes I've seen mortgages that were 15-year loans, and so the payment was too high.
Uh-huh.
But if it could be refinanced with a 30-year,
sure,
then the payment was affordable given the spousal support or other income.
So that makes a lot of sense. 15-year loan is pretty unusual nowadays.
Yeah. But some people still have them.
Got it. Okay. How retirement plans are treated in divorce, plan settlement, long-term consequences. We talked a little bit about this previously, but retirement plans are, the nest egg, right? That's I guess, the rainy day fund when we hope to not have to work anymore. That's the idea, right?
Well, that's the idea. And when there's a divorce, then each person gets half. So each person has less to retire on, or generally they're going to have to work longer. So it's a consideration in looking out into the future. If you're dividing the pension plans in half, how much more are you going to have to earn, or how much longer are you going to have to work to have enough assets to, in fact, retire?
Right, and I would imagine with the certified financial planner abbreviation there, you probably can do some calculation to determine how much money a person's going to need, how long they have to work, some general ballpark stuff as far as that goes, right?
Yes. Generally, I do a net cash flow analysis, and it's based on assumptions of how much a person is going to earn or how much support
sure.
is, how long support will last, what are their living expenses now, what are they going to be in the future, and what resources are they going to have available so that they have a sense of their future and they can make plans to make it as good as they can. Right.
So someone might come to you, I know it's a hypothetical situation, but you're to run the analysis and say, okay, if we split up the pension plan now and you get this divorce, you'll have to work an extra 10 years.
That could be one of the outcomes, right? Yeah.
Wow, maybe they rethink this whole divorce thing.
Well, sometimes people rethink it.
Got it. I mean, that's a real slap in the face, though, when you consider this person that I once loved, perhaps my marriage has run its course, we're done with it, but to consider that I'm going to have to work an extra 10 years or some amount of time longer, and trading those non-working years for being with this person, maybe they're able to forgive a little bit more.
Mm, well, I don't know. Sometimes they do. I guess those would be the people I don't see. But but there's more and more people who are getting divorced in later years. The baby boomers are in their 50s and 60s, and people have an expectation of living longer. And so sometimes they get that divorce even though they've been married 30, 35 years, then they split the pension. So that does have a significant consequence on what the rest of their life is going to look like. A lot of my clients, most of them, are at least in their 40s, and many of them are in their 50s.
Wow. So you're seeing people getting divorces after 30 and 35 years of marriage.
Yes.
I would have thought we were over the hump at 15 to 20.
No.
No. Well, that's frankly a little bit discouraging. Sorry to hear that. Okay. Let's see. Understand pension assets occurred during the marriage both belong to or belong to both spouses, which is kind of what you described, hence the splitting, right?
And right. So sometimes people will say, well, it has my name on it and I earned it and it's my employer, so that's my pension plan. But that isn't the way it works.
That's not the way it works. Community property.
Community property. And there needs to be a quadro, which is a qualified domestic relations order for company pension plans, for 401ks and defined benefit plans. So that's an extra cost of the divorce. And it needs to be done. People shouldn't let it hang out there because that isn't part, generally speaking, it isn't part of their marital settlement agreement. It's an extra agreement that needs to be done for pension plans.
Oh, so in addition to marital settlement agreement, the quadro specifically speaks about the pension.
Exactly.
And it's the official form for delineating who gets what in the pension?
Yes. And there needs to be a quadro for each pension plan. Doesn't need to be one for IRAs. But 401k, a defined benefit plan, if those are going to be divided, then they need their own quadro.
Say what that stands for again.
A qualified domestic relations order.
Got it. And that's so whoever is the pension plan administrator knows what to do with the money.
Right, exactly.
Got it. Makes sense. If you don't have a quadro out there, it's time. Sounds very exciting, by the way, to go out and get a quadro.
Yeah, I drive stuff up.
We're talking with Cinda Jones, DivorceFinancialSolutions.com. That's our website, DivorceFinancialSolutions.com. Talking about some of the key issues to consider when going through the divorce process. Again, let's hope that you're not, but should you be in that position, get a hold of Cinda, DivorceFinancialSolutions.com. She can point you in the right direction. Who can afford the house? Buyout possibilities, realistic in terms of trading assets. I mean, we talked a little bit about buyout possibilities, but I would imagine just about every time something has to be done with the house. Right?
Yes, yeah, something has to be done with the house. People can continue to own it together. They can make an agreement that one person lives in it for a period of time and then it will be sold, or over a period of time, then one person will buy the other person out. But it's an asset. It's generally speaking a valuable asset that needs to be addressed in the marital settlement agreement.
And some of those, so the obvious solution is to sell it or refinance it. Take money out and refinance it. We talked about a reverse mortgage briefly. I think that the options are fairly in your face, so to speak, as far as what's to be done with the house. And I guess this is all assuming that there's equity in the home. Should there not be equity, maybe, you know, one spouse is willing to say, hey, I'll leave my name on there and trade it for something else.
Yes, they can definitely do that. They can trade it for other investment assets or maybe other property. So there's doesn't have to be divided or even split or have a loan if they don't want to. They can trade it with other assets, or they can just it can just be awarded to one individual because that's the way they want it.
Got it. You have tax issues. For example, receiving the house is not a sale. No capital gain or loss consequences?
That's right. That falls under some of the special rules with the IRS. There's not a sale. It isn't considered a sale when one spouse gets the house in a divorce. So spouse A did not sell it to spouse B. It's part of the settlement agreement, and it isn't subject to taxes.
Interspousal transfer.
Right.
Interspousal. And there's a deed. You fill it out. Crown recorder, $20. Right. And as far as that's concerned, you know, you're not on the, or whoever is deeding off the property is no longer on the property. Simple enough as far as that goes. It's nice that the IRS doesn't get involved in that.
Right. Yes, that's good.
Tax basis of the real estate or investments for later sales.
Yeah, and that's an important issue to think about. Sometimes there's a huge capital gain, so people need to know that. If they have commercial real estate, they really need to take a look at what the tax basis is and what the consequences of the depreciation are that have been taken over the years, because that's recaptured, so sometimes that isn't understood.
That can be quite complicated. Yeah, right. Depreciation recapture is not an easy thing to calculate. Frankly, it's something that nobody thinks about in the beginning. Depreciation is wonderful while you own it over those, 29 and a half or 39 and a half years, but recaptures, nobody likes that. That's no fun.
That's no fun.
We're talking with Cinda Jones, Divorce Financial Solutions. That's her website, divorcefinancialsolutions.com. She's kind of the central hub of this unmarriage process, can assist you in pointing you in the right direction for an attorney based on the specific outcome and the specific process you want to have in place, and also is an expert in terms of pension evaluation and really everything money related with respect to the separation of this business. Reach out to Cinda should you find yourself in this situation. DivorceFinancialSolutions.com. That's the website, DivorceFinancialSolutions.com. Cinda, I want to thank you for joining us.
It's been a pleasure to be here. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Everybody out there, have a great 4th of July. We'll talk to you next week.